Welcome to Speak Up, Speak Out, progressive voices from around the valley and around the nation, conversing about issues important to our community.
Welcome to another edition of Speak Up, Speak Out. Tonight we are privileged to have as our guest Doug, Alyssa, Evan, and Ash of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if we could start off. Alyssa, could you tell us a bit about, for people listening, what is Iraq Veterans Against the War and how did you get involved?
Right. Iraq Veterans Against the War is kind of, as the name implies, basically a nationwide group of Iraq veterans or any service member who served since 9/11. And we are against the war. Our three main goals are to end the war in Iraq, to bring about reparations for the Iraqi people, and to support the veterans themselves by any kind of way that's really possible. And personally, I became involved. Actually, my story is a little bit complicated. I was in Iraq actually from August 06 until October 07, so I've only been back a couple of months at this point. While I was in Iraq, I kind of had a sort of actually just a really major change in who I am and what I think and just really about everything, and that led me to believing actually totally against any war, and of course then the Iraq war as well. And I sort of went through a crazy process. I applied for status as a conscientious objector, which was denied, but then through all of that, it was really just me realizing that how incredibly wrong this war is, how it really is an illegal war, and really just the effects that it's having on the Iraqi people is just devastating to watch and to, you know, just to imagine them being a part of it. A million people dead and imagining, you know, what would your life be like if you could die really at any moment, because that's really what's happening over there. People are being kidnapped, being killed every day, like right now, that's happening. And it was just immense for me to be a part of that, to know that what I'm doing, even while I'm in my isolated little place, the work that I'm doing is killing people. It was just immense for me. I couldn't really keep going with that. And so I became a part of IVAW as really my attempt to end what was happening there.
So can you tell us a little bit more about your process of looking to becoming a conscientious objector?
Yeah, well, there were several main experiences that brought me to that point, and it was really just kind of an accumulation of all of those things. One thing that was totally shocking to me, I was in Iraq, I'd been there for a couple of months, and, you know, one thing that's really strange in my job, we were very isolated just in this little intelligence community, and I never actually met with or talked to the Iraqi people. And I realized after a couple of months, I haven't seen children for, you know, the whole time I've been here. It was just strange. So one day I was in this truck. I was next to the wall. We were getting ready to go somewhere. And I heard kids playing outside. They were playing soccer or something like that. And it was just so exciting. I was like, oh my God, I hear kids playing, whatever. And I told my platoon sergeant, just excited to hear the children. And he said, oh, go climb up on the wall. They're probably planting IEDs, you should shoot them. And I was just blown away, like, oh my God, are you kidding me? These are kids. I would know. And of course, that's not what they're doing. They're playing soccer. You know, and it was kind of just a series of experiences like that. Or I had a commander who talked every day about wanting to catch this certain man and cut off his fingers and cut off his testicles. And it was just, whoa. And this guy, I mean, he hadn't really done anything. It was just this commander wanted someone to hate, basically, so he chose this man. And it was just realizing the inhumanity of people who are forced to deal with a situation like that, the way that you demonize the enemy in order to keep surviving, to keep killing them, and keep doing what you have to do, and really to not lose your own mind. And just watching this happen to the people around me and people I'd known and, you know, all of this, it just...
You create a mob mentality.
Exactly.
Being in the military or being in a war zone, you're creating a mob mentality where you're not really thinking, you know, it's like the IQ of everyone goes drastically down. You're taught in the military to follow the person in charge of you and not to question authority. And when you start questioning what's going on, you get in a lot of trouble. You see that all the time.
I definitely agree with the mob mentality thing. It's the same thing that happened in Nazi Germany. People say, well, you need to support the troops. And then 4 or 5 years later, we get that caveat on the end and their mission, right? That's the message that they have that they're putting out now, right? Again, it's just this mob mentality. That's what it was all along, but finally now they're admitting it.
And, you know, that's really shocking to see what that does to a person when you start to think that way. I mean, just watching people who are loving with their children and their spouses and all of this, really kind and gentle people, and then they turn automatically to being able to kill someone, I don't know, became for me something that I absolutely saw as murder, just everything that's happening there. It's just shocking to see that change happen in someone. And I realized that I didn't want that to happen to me. I couldn't be the person who could so easily take someone's life and never think about it and joke about it and think that it was funny and a good thing.
And, you know, people say, well, they joined the army. They wanted to, you know, they knew they were going to have to take people's lives. They knew they were going to have to put themselves in danger. And it was all voluntary. It's not. That is the biggest lie that is destroying our military. And it's the same lie that led to the Holocaust in a different form. We didn't join, I didn't join, Alyssa didn't join, Doug didn't join, Ash didn't join, to kill people. We did not go to Iraq to take lives. We went to rebuild the country. And, of course, that's not what we're doing. That only becomes obvious to some people, like me, who are thick-skulled, after several months, a year of being there.
I also want to quickly introduce, we have Ben Marks on the phone. Ben, can you hear us?
Yeah, I sure can.
Wonderful. Ben, maybe you could kind of introduce yourself a bit. You're a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War from Seattle, is that correct?
That's right.
All right. Well, just feel free to jump in the conversation. Can you tell us a little bit how you came to be involved?
Certainly. I'm a two-tour Iraq veteran. I was a former company commander. My last tour in Iraq, I commanded a transportation company, which was basically retooled as a convoy defense or gun truck company. And we were in charge of running gun truck support and convoy defense in and around the Sunni Triangle in central Iraq. So that kind of goes in line with what Evan was speaking of there a few minutes ago, with soldiers join the military for certain reasons, whether it's idealism or a skill or something like that. And this is kind of an issue or a byproduct of the occupation now, where soldiers are sent into this fray and they're not performing their skill that they're trained for. One of the reasons why I joined IVAW was, as an officer, we were told to preach a party line. We were told to motivate soldiers and tell them that we were defending freedom. We were helping to establish a foothold of democracy in the Middle East. And you know it's a fabrication. You know it's a lie. And having to preach that to soldiers and lead them into a morally bankrupt situation for me was very damaging. It was very emotionally damaging and psychologically damaging. But not only that, to see what my soldiers went through and what I personally led them through during this occupation drove me directly to be against it. And that's why I'm a part of IVAW today.
Ben, this is Jenny. I met you on Monday night in Bellingham. Hi.
Good evening, Jenny.
Hi. You mentioned when we were talking, you made an interesting comment to me. This is maybe a little bit of a segue, but you were talking about motives that, you know, why people, I'm sure they're all over the board, why people enlist or volunteer to go over to join the service and end up in Iraq. And you made the comment that the contractors, in some cases, aren't the only mercenary force. Could you talk to that about that a little bit?
Well, it's true, and I think this speaks to the cultural shift that the military is going through today. Soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan are getting money and incentives thrown at them right and left. Just in my company alone, I had 140 soldiers that I was in charge of over there, and one of the biggest goals or the biggest requirements for officers and anyone on the panel can probably speak to this is to increase retention and increase recruitment and retain soldiers within the Army as a whole. Money is thrown at soldiers to reenlist over there like crazy. Basically, you talk to soldiers about staying in the Army, but it's also that monetary incentive. Look, do you want this big bonus? Well, then sign up for another 3, 4, 6 years. And I had 67 soldiers just in my company alone that reenlisted while deployed to Iraq. And it wasn't for the idealism. It wasn't for belief in the cause. It was for the money.
Ben, maybe you can add in there about the stop loss. I know that probably had something to do with it, too.
Well, you know, stop loss is a byproduct of this whole war, of this whole occupation. You have soldiers that, you know, the minute they're assigned to a company that, or a unit, or it could be a brigade that comes down under a deployment order, the entire personnel strength of that unit is frozen. Soldiers can't go out. Soldiers can't go to career advancing schools, or go to a different post, a different assignment. They're basically frozen within the deployment cycle of that unit. The soldiers can come in, but they can't leave, and that's for the duration of that deployment order. So me personally, I was stop loss for a period of 4 years, and that's following 9/11, returning from overseas in Korea and coming back to the continental U.S. I was assigned to units that were continually under deployment orders. So going from one unit to the next, or Enduring Freedom, Afghanistan, and then Iraq for the two tours there, and that's not an uncommon story. I mean, that's a fine print that a lot of soldiers in their contracts just don't read, or it's intentionally not preached to them.
Well, the stop loss, in the contract, the stop loss says that in case of war, the military can hold on to you for 6 months after the war is over. But as of yet, we have not declared a war, so I feel like the stop loss is an illegal thing that the military is doing. Because if we don't have a war, how can you pull this out?
Well, and not to mention the tie-in to the reenlistment rates and the retention rates. I mean, soldiers facing imminent stop loss or stop movement or involuntary extension, they're going to be kept in anyway. Why not sign up and put your name on the line, because you'll be going back one way or another, and make $20,000 out of the deal.
So soldiers are being forced to reenlist instead of being stop-lost. And these are numbers that, you know, that don't show up because it's being dangled in front of their faces, saying you're going to get stop-lost, or you can sign up for another couple of years and get $10,000, which you're going to be in anyway, so you might as well just reenlist.
Absolutely, and one of the things that's completely unjust is there's no grace period. There's no statute of limitations. You can have a senior non-commissioned officer that spent 22, 24 years in the military and be on the verge of retirement. There, his or her unit comes under a deployment order, and their term of enlistment is basically involuntarily extended, and that goes for first term, second term soldiers as well. You could be in the unit one day expecting to exit the Army the next and begin your civilian life. You get a deployment order and you're in for an additional basically 18 months for the duration of that deployment.
One of the other things that has been brought up in our conversations tonight is the discharge policy. Can someone talk a bit about that?
Yes, Doug. I noticed while I was at Walter Reed that a lot of people coming back, you know, they had emotional problems, PTSD, etc. If the decision's left up to a company commander or someone in a military chain of command to decide whether the soldier's inappropriate actions is worthy of, you know, getting out or being kicked out or being treated, they almost always side with the getting kicked out. Now, something I'm worried about, I mean, this goes to the military deterioration, is that if they're doing this, the people that get out, they don't get any treatment when they're done. I mean, we just had a case last week, made front page of the Washington Post. Lieutenant Whiteside, shot herself in the stomach in an attempted suicide, and she's facing life in prison because her company commander back at Walter Reed decided that she needed to be held accountable for her actions even though her doctors were saying that she was in a dissociative state when this happened and that she needs further mental health treatment. And this kind of goes, the military's tried to implement this warrior ethos system, at least in the Army, and I think it's backfiring because there's really no compassion. And
it's empty.
It is. It's empty. Oh, by the way, it also saves them money. If you kick someone out and you don't have to treat them for their traumatic brain injury they received or their post-traumatic stress disorder, then the numbers look good.
So veterans are getting kicked out of the military or getting released out of the military with other than honorable discharges, meaning that they don't get VA health care, they don't get education benefits that they're promised and signed up for. So the thing that people don't understand is that all military contracts are unilateral, meaning that the military can change it and you still have to stick up to your side of the contract, but you can never change your side of the contract.
And it's another thing, too. We're fighting this war that these soldiers may or may not have agreed to go fight. You know, they get lied to by recruiters, number one. Number two, many of them have been stop-loss, joined before 9/11, before the beginning of the Iraq War, did not agree to go fight this war. And I think it's really important to note that after you go to Iraq the second time and get divorced while you're in Iraq, you know, have huge, massive PTSD problems, and you try to get help for it, they don't treat you. There's really only one real option for you, and that's to get a other than honorable, general under honorable, or less than honorable discharge by either misbehaving or going crazy or going AWOL. The military has closed off every loophole to get out. It's tragic because these people signed up to help their country, they helped their country, and now they're being screwed over because they just can't get out and they don't know how to help themselves, and nobody in the Army is going to help them.
Absolutely.
And I know, Ash, you had a kind of a human face.
Yeah, when I was in Iraq, I was working with a civil affairs group. We were doing security for them. And a couple weeks earlier, one of our convoys going north from Kuwait up to Baghdad had hit a small girl and a couple goats. So the military went, brought the civil affairs. Those are our liaison to the local civilians, bringing them like health care or like a doctor or whatever, water to town. We went to this village and we went to this family. We paid them off in bills. A lieutenant colonel, you know, walks around. A lieutenant colonel in Iraq will walk around with $10,000 and $100 bills in his pocket and go to these towns and either buy off the Iraqi resistors or, you know, anything that he needs to shell out some money for, and pay this family back the going market value for a daughter, and you know, a 9-year-old girl and two goats, which just happened to be that each goat was worth twice that of the daughter. So they paid them, I think, $2,500 total for this accident that happened. And the going rate of the daughter was half of a goat.
Well, and of course, you know, killing children in Iraq is not anything that's unusual. Let's talk about this. You know, the policy for most units, they're on convoys, and, oh, you're driving down the street and a child runs out in the road. The unit policy is that you keep driving. You don't stop for anything. That means you run over the kid. And really, like Ash said, this policy of giving families money for their loved ones killed, I saw that when I was there, too. That happens all over the time. I mean, all over the place. And what is that, really? What kind of military is this? It's going to kill people and then give their family members money because they were killed. Is that, like, a payment for the death? What kind of culture is this that we're looking at?
You know, it's one of those policy things, I think, that you have a bunch of these little policies that all five of us can attest to, you know, dozens of these policies each, and they all add up to something greater of some type of philosophical importance. I'm not smart enough to be able to figure out, but I think it has something to do with the ineptitude of the military for this supposed mission, and possibly the moral standing of our foreign policy, which supposedly we base this war upon.
You know, I think at the bottom of this too, I mean, obviously it's a flawed policy. It was flawed from the beginning. But what's not discussed and what's not investigated is the overarching racism of this actual policy.
Right.
We're there, you know, as a coalition, supposedly, you know, after this invasion, after we've completely destroyed this company or this country, and we're turning it into a company. That's a whole other issue. The policy now is these people in Iraq cannot stand up for themselves. They cannot develop their own country. They've had a society. They've had an entire country, a whole entire national identity for thousands and thousands of years before we were even an inkling here in the U.S. So the overarching racism is just something that's not discussed.
I was in a medical unit, right? And you'd think we'd be a little bit more enlightened when it comes to cultural awareness, etc. And we were really socialized to not like the Iraqis. I mean, the first description of an Iraqi I got over there was, I mean, I didn't know the word Haji before I went over there. 3 months into my tour, I noticed my vernacular had changed, and I was calling people Hajis, and I'd been an Arabic, you know, linguist, enlisted. I have an Egyptian uncle. It's really just, that's one small part, but, you know, I'd hear people all the time talking about, you know, if the Hajis would just learn how to drive, what are we going to pay this Haji off now? I mean, and these
what's
are
the
people
who, what's the difference between Haji and Japs and gooks and all these terms that we've used and krauts that we used before to demonize the enemy? It's the same exact, it's literally the same exact pattern that we've followed for every single war.
Well, think about it. If we didn't do that, if they didn't have a policy to do that, they couldn't put out policies like, if there's a kid in the way, you don't stop the convoy. Because if we gave their children just as much love and respect as we're taught to in our culture, the war would crumble. We wouldn't be able to follow half of the orders that are given, and they know that.
They tell you, I mean, this is stuff that I hear from Vietnam, and it's still used today, that watch out for the kids, watch out for the kids. They're going to drop hand grenades in your vehicles. And they're always throwing that out there, that these kids are going to drop hand grenades in your vehicles. And it reminds me of that the old wives' tale of the razor blades and the apples for Halloween, you know. There's really no account of this, but we're gonna put it out there.
Or the peace activists who spit on Vietnam veterans when they got off the plane, which is completely unfounded.
And one other thing that I'd like to say is, as we're getting kind of close to the end of our time, I'm wondering if you guys, we were speaking earlier, this has been an ongoing conversation, and you were talking about how when you returned, how in a daze and how lost you really felt until you found each other. If there are veterans who are just returning or suffering right now listening tonight, what would you want to say to them?
You are not alone. I know I felt that way when I got back, but, you know, we are here for you. You have a community of people who have been over there. We support each other, and it's been the best thing for me. And so if you're sitting like I was in my apartment, half suicidal and depressed, or just feeling like you can't relate to the world around you, please check out our website, www.ivaw.org. If you're in the Billingham area, it's billingham@ivaw.org. Just shoot us an email. We'll call you right back.
I think we've all been suicidal at some point, but we're all here today, and there's a reason for that. I think Ben and Alyssa and Ash and Doug can all attest to that.
We're here to make a stand, and we want to support each other, but we also want to end this illegal occupation and make it so there's no more veterans have to come back and deal with the same things that we've dealt with and that are continuing to deal with. These PTSD, all these things that are happening to us, these are lifelong problems that we're going to be dealing with for our whole life. We need to have a support network to deal with these situations.
You know, it's kind of an exclusive club that we run here, but it's a club that we don't want more people to have to join as a last resort.
Nobody goes to Iraq, I mean, whether it's soldiers or people that are involved in this occupation, nobody goes there and comes back intact. Everybody comes back damaged. And soldiers returning, everyone has something to offer. And we're the ones that are going to be speaking to this, what we've experienced, and are going to be on the forefront of actually ending this occupation. When it comes down to it, if we rely on the motivations of our so-called administration, there's no light at the end of the tunnel, and this will be an occupation, this will be a debacle that we hand to our children, and that's what we're trying to stop now.
In the 2 minutes we have left, I know that you have an event going on this Friday that you wanted to talk about, and I wanted to know what other activities, counter-recruitment, that sort of thing, IVAW is doing both here in Seattle. Go for it.
Well, IVAW is very active in Bellingham and also in Seattle. The Bellingham chapter is new. Ash Wilson here is our president. Again, you can get in touch with him at bellingham@ivaw.org. I personally, Evan, I run the counter-recruiting program in Whatcom County. Doug here is going to be giving a talk. Maybe, Ash, you can...
Yeah, Doug's going to be giving a talk at the Whatcom Peace and Justice Center Friday the 14th. That's this Friday. 6 o'clock's a potluck, and he's going to give a presentation of a video that he made at his surgical ICU unit in Mosul, and he'll also be giving question and answers afterwards. So that's 7 o'clock on Friday the 14th at Whatcom Peace and Justice Center.
And also, if there's any veterans that are listening to this of the Iraq War or any time after 2001, we would really love to hear from you, and we're interested in getting your input. Please contact us again, bellingham@ivaw.org.
Ben, we have about 20 seconds. Any last words?
Now, we have an intense active duty outreach campaign that's coming up here in Seattle. We'll be sending a delegation north to B.C. to show solidarity with the current war resistors and get their stories and see how we can assist here this weekend. Also, we're building momentum for the Winter Soldier campaign in Washington, D.C. in March. And just what Evan was speaking to there, we'll be reaching out to active duty to get their stories, also to veterans as well, see if we can get returning veterans to testify for Winter Soldier.
So if there are people here in Skagit County who want to start an IVAW chapter, would you all be there to assist them?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, we're really pushing for a Skagit Valley IVAW chapter. I know that there's about 400 veterans in this valley, and IVAW is open to anyone that's been active duty since September 11th. So,
actually, not just active duty, anybody serving in the military since September 11th.
So your website, one more time.
IVAW.org.
All right. Thank you so much, you all, for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Join us each week for Speak Up, Speak Out. Archives are at speakupspeakoutradio.org. Theme music courtesy of Kurt Crandall. Until next time, seek peace, work for justice, celebrate diversity, and support your neighbors.
This program was produced in the studios of KSVR-FM by the Speak Up, Speak Out Collective. Distribution was made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.